Mental health is a pivotal part of the profession of occupational therapy, and it's one practice area that I absolutely love learning about. So today, I brought on Danielle Miles to talk about her work in mental health. Danielle is an occupational therapist who works on a behavioral inpatient mental health unit. In the episode, she shares what this practice area looks like, her role as an OT, and also how she navigates her own mental health while working in this setting. If you're interested in occupational therapy, this is the place for you. This show aims to explore our profession by sharing who we are and what we do. Because for us, occupational therapy is more than just a job. Hi, I'm Sarah Putt. I've been an occupational therapist since 2009, specializing in early intervention and also run my own private practice in this setting. Welcome to OT for Life. Welcome to the show, Danielle. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited to have you on the show and to jump into a practice area that honestly, I don't know all that much about, but I'm really excited to learn a little bit more today. So I know that you currently work on a behavioral health inpatient mental health unit, but I also know that you originally didn't want to work in mental health. So what is it about this practice area that has drawn you to it?
It's funny that you ask me that. Just to give you a little brief background about myself, I worked as a physical therapist assistant for 17 years, decided to go back to school to become an occupational therapist in 2014. I made some life changes and career change to a holistic approach rather than a body part, and even had to relocate. So it was quite a change for me. Never thought about working in mental health. You know, I had experience with PhysDis, worked in nursing homes, hospitals, acute inpatient, all of that before becoming an OT. So when I went to school for it, I realized that, there's a big difference between OT and PT. We're looking at people totally different. So I had to think differently. More theory approach, occupation wise. It's not all about how the person walks. The injured part is more than just that. So anyways, my perspective, while I was going through clinicals and doing the coursework, I said, I might get into it. I'm like, give me a shoulder, give me a hand, give me a wrist. Let's handle it, you know, show them some adaptive equipment and let's be done with it. Well, after graduation, I kind of got me a job in subacute. Since I already worked as a physical therapist assistant at the time, I was able to network with people with around the area because I was working PRN as a PT assistant and letting people know that, you know, I'm going back to school for OT. The window's open. I graduate this time. Let me get my foot in the door. So I did some subacute work, long-term care, outpatient, acute. So I did all of this within a year. And it was part-time. I couldn't find full-time work. I was very unhappy. I spent hours. I'm at work at 8 o'clock sometimes in the morning and then get out to 9, 10 o'clock at night. I said, this is not what I bargained for. This is not what I want. You know, I have no life. So I just kept my eyes and ears open, still continue to network with people around the area. And, you know, as a first new grad, they always say we want somebody with at least a year, 2 years of experience. So you got to get the job that's available. So I had to crawl again, you know, before I walked, and come to find out I'm in a part-time position. I'm working all these different places for one organization, acute, subacute, outpatient, all of that just to get 40 hours a week. And this job came up. It was like mental health at a trauma one center. I'm like, what? I said, that's a full-time job, good benefits. Who knows? You know, I said, well, I don't know. I got issues on myself. I don't know if I can deal with working with mental health. Deal with depression for a while and anxiety. So I know how I can be as an individual and try to understand what it's all about. And it's such a stigma in my community. It took a while for me and my family to adjust to being diagnosed with such things like depression and anxiety. So I said, well, hey, whatever. I got some experience. I worked as a CNA before I became a PT assistant.
Oh, wow. Lots of experience.
Lots of experience. So you have to think, it's like, do we treat people by their diagnosis or do we treat people as people? You know what I mean? So I ended up going to this interview. It was a 3-panel interview. Pretty much been out of school for a year almost, and they wasn't expecting the resume, and they wasn't expecting the experience and exposure that I had. They weren't expecting me, okay? me, for one, as an African-American woman. Two, for me having all the experience and exposure that I had. And three, for the knowledge and how I was answering and responding to the questions that they were trying to give me. It got so good that, you know how you at the interview, they have the questions all on the paper. Well, they had flipped the pages a couple times. They was coming with the questions and I was coming with the answers. Yeah. And I think they say, well, if you never worked in an environment like this, what makes you think you can work in this environment? I said, you come in contact with people every day. We don't label the people that we treat. Schizophrenia, bipolar, depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress syndrome, all those things that come into play. You don't address the diagnosis, you address the person. So we had to find ways to help to get them to be able to function and perform their daily occupations. We don't treat the diagnosis. We're just allowing them to cope, to work, you know, go through their daily lives. That's it. We don't treat them any differently. Sometimes they have, people have behavioral problems, but we're trying to help them get through that. We can't fix it, but we can help them cope. And that's pretty much, and they just, I took a full whirlwind with that. You know what I mean? You come with people every day. If it's FSDs, if it's PEDS, no matter the diagnosis, we're treating the person for the occupation that they're having the dysfunction in. That's it. Not the diagnosis. We're not the doctor. So anyways, to make a long story short, I got the job.
And here you are.
And here I am. And I'm a people person. I keep it real with individuals. And when you're working with that population, they can see right through you. They see if you're honest. They see if you're sincere. They see if you have empathy for them. And you have to speak to people at their level. When we went to school and they trained us about therapeutic use of self, that's what you're doing. You are using therapy to use yourself. You need to know how to speak with people as people. You want respect, you give respect. And that's when you have to show that sincerity. Otherwise, they'll shut you down. They'll see right through you like paper thin.
Yeah, like that wall goes up. They're like, nope.
Yeah.
Get out.
Because they get enough of that. You know, you got the white coat syndrome. They automatically shut down. These people just want to, you know, they got me here. I don't want to be here. You know, I don't know why I'm here. And your job as an OT is just to try to help get them through those days.
Yeah. So let's do, and I know you've kind of thrown in a little bit as you've just been telling the past story, but let's dive into a little bit more about like what working at your current facility, what it actually looks like and the frequency, duration that you're seeing clients, maybe some common diagnoses, like that type of stuff, like the general overview of what it looks like at your facility.
At my facility, it is a Trauma One facility. So in the build, the hospital itself is mainly located in the inner city of Buffalo, New York. So we're kind of getting all walks of park that comes through the facility. There is two types of emergency rooms at this facility. There's the basic emergency room that everybody goes through. Everybody goes through this emergency room. But when they run it through a different kinds of assessments and seeing their typical behaviors, they say, is this a medical situation that we can deal with? Or do we need to send them to the mental health emergency room, which they call it CPAP? So it's like ICU of emergency for mental health diagnosis when people's having some trouble. Diagnoses that might run through there are bipolar, schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, depression, anxiety, personality disorders, antisocial behavior disorders, oppositional defiance disorders, because you have children that's also that comes through there as well. You have suicide attempts. People who have inflicted themselves to try to commit suicide that run through there. But usually, typically, if there's some type of injury where they attempted to do the suicide but didn't fall through, it usually go through the emergency room, through medical. Once they're cleared through medical, then they end up coming onto the psych floor.
Are these, just to jump in for a second, are some of the people, are they coming in with these diagnoses? Are they getting diagnosed when they're at the ICU emergency room setting? A combination of both?
Combination of both. Some okay. people are like first adjustment disorders, you know, something happened in their lives and things just spiral healed and then they get labeled as an adjustment disorder and then eventually they diagnose them after different type of mental health examinations, different doctors, psychologists, social works, all those different disciplines are checking them out. Some people already have these diagnoses, may have just stopped taking their meds. And or drug psychosis, you know, a lot of people take drugs to help cope with the medications. They don't want to take their meds. They say, I can just take this marijuana. I'll try this thing out and I'll be good. And it's a hot mess. So they examine, they assess the patient. They figure out, is this person safe? Is the person safe? If the person is not safe, then most likely they will admit the patient to an inpatient floor. And that's when they'll end up seeing myself. Or they'll put them in an observation. So it's like an observation room where they hold them for about 24 or 48 hours. Then they'll decide, do we need to keep them as an admission? Or do we send them home and just give them the resources that they need, like counseling out in the community, medications, change of meds, and so forth?
So what typical ages are you seeing?
Typically from 12 to geriatrics.
Wide range.
Yes. The kids units typically from 12 to 17. Once they hit 18, they're on the adult units. So we keep the kids separated from the other populations.
Okay. And would you say, as far as like your caseload, do you see mainly on the kids, the pediatric, mainly the adults, or is it a mix of both?
My units that I'm responsible for now is the adult units. I have two different adult units. I have a mixed bagged unit where I see all different diagnoses on a particular unit. The other unit I work on is considered like first break. So the psychosis for schizophrenia. So these are first break patients for the most part. People can have first break as young as maybe 14, 16. They develop psychosis, hallucinations, delusions, the whole nine yards.
Yeah, that's being somebody that's not super familiar with working in mental health as an OT. I am like, my brain just automatically starts thinking about like, are there big differences between some of the maybe older populations that have already been diagnosed and they've been dealing with this, as opposed to the, what you call it, the first break unit,
the like first
the
break.
Ones that, yeah, where it's like initially happening, and what,
yes,
what are those differences?
That's a big difference. I feel like the first break is the, oh my goodness, I'm not really understanding what's going on. Don't want to take these meds. Okay, I may take other substances to help cope with certain things. Families looking at them like, this is weird. They never acted like this. Now they're acting really off versus somebody who's has the diagnosis of schizophrenia. They remind me of when I used to work on a memory care unit. They can be that psychotic. Their memory, it's like their thought process is really totally off. Sometimes it's very difficult to understand. They jump from topic to topic. You're like, where the heck am I at? What is this person trying to explain to me? So these are the people that's been on meds and stopped meds and taking drugs, put back on meds. You know, and it's hard to control if they're not managing it correctly. And they're older. So some of them are set in their ways. Some support systems aren't really there like that. Some people may be homeless. Some people may have financial difficulties, or their social supports aren't there anymore because they don't know how to manage or understand the diagnosis themselves, or even how to deal with a family member or friend. Usually in this situation, you know, there's more resources to try to find people the adequate resources they need to function. If it's making sure they get a shot every day or every week to maintain the medications because they're not taking them as prescribed, is it because they need additional housing that assists them with those? So it's like one extreme to the next. And you see people recover. You see them come in, they're very acute. And then you can see them come out where they are at their baseline. And everybody's baseline is different.
How do you navigate as a professional working with these differences of the first breaks and kind of the people that have been in the system, or they maybe have been there multiple times? And yeah, how do you navigate going from seeing one of those clients to seeing a different set? Is that hard?
The days are not always easy. I can go in one day, somebody has tried to commit suicide, maybe have been intubated, they brought them back to life, and they're suffering depression of all the things that's going on in the world or their own life problems, to dealing with somebody who says, you know, they're the richest person in the world, and I walk in line with God, I know Drake and Tupac. You know, it goes from one extreme to the next, and it's like you really have to know how to use your therapeutic use of self. to make them feel comfortable enough to build rapport with them. Sometimes you have to role play until they get to the point where they're at a place where their thought process is a little bit more organized. They're understanding what needs to be done and have more insight for what's going on with them. Sometimes it happens. Sometimes it never happens. And that can be frustrating.
Yeah.
But as an OT, seeing, you're looking at the chart reviews, you're reading all what's happening with the patient. So by the time you see them, it could be totally different. It could be a whole 180. Like what I just read, this person is not demonstrating those type of characteristics by what I just read. So sometimes I do read, sometimes I don't. I don't want to have a biased opinion on it, but I do look at certain things like their violence score. Are they aggressive? Maybe just a little bit of history. But for the most part, I ask the nurse. I go up on the unit. I ask the nurse, is this person appropriate for me to talk to? Is there anything I need to know? So that's pretty much how I look at it before I go in to see a patient. Psychologically, for myself in the job, you need outlets. You need coping skills. We're teaching patients coping skills. You need self-care.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a must. You know, if I want to get a pedicure on the weekend, if I just want to come home and listen to nothing, if I'm typing and I'm seeing all these people when I'm typing in a vowel, I'll put in some lo-fi music, nothing with words, put my earplugs in and zone out. I need that quiet time because sometimes I just don't feel like talking to anybody after I get off work. I just need that time. Exercise, everything.
So I love the fact that you just brought up reading / not reading / kind of scanning reports because, well, A, what we do as occupational therapy practitioners is really hard. Whether you're in mental health, whether you're in pediatrics, whether you're in a skilled nursing facility, regardless of practice area, the stuff that we see on a daily basis can be very emotionally draining on us as practitioners. And yes. I know for me, when I get a new referral or a new eval or something like that, there are very minimal details that I will look for in a report or in any sort of paperwork that I've gotten on the client. But I've learned over my years that a lot of times if I'm reading specifically like somebody else's evaluation report, the kid could have been having a bad day.
Exactly.
They could have changed a lot from maybe that was like a month ago and now they've already mm-hmm. like hit all these milestones. Maybe there were just some kind of inaccuracies that were within that report. Maybe that's what that evaluator saw. But when I go in, I've noticed so many times that I'll go in and be like, this is not the kid that I was expecting. Like I was expecting a kid bouncing right. off the walls or trying to hit me. And here's the kid like, hi, I'm here. Like, what are we going to do? Are we going to play today? And I'm like, wait, what is going on?
Right, right.
And I think it's a really valuable skill because A, you have to know the violence, right? In your mm-hmm. situation, you have to know if they're going to be violent and how receptive they are going to be of you. But if you're reading all this really, really difficult emotional stuff and you go in and almost like portray that back to them, they're going to see that and they're going to read that on you. And I think it's such an important skill to really know what you need to know, but then also not kind of be tainted by some of the other information that other people might have projected or have seen within these clients.
Yes. I actually tell my patients that. I go in, I say, listen, I know you've talked to maybe several clinicians or seven providers up in here. I said, well, I'm 7+1. I may scan a little bit, but I know nothing about you and I don't want to form any type of biased opinion of you. So I want to just keep it straight with no chaser. I talk to them like, and then they start to feel a little bit comfortable. I'm not just talking like I'm reading a script from a book. I'm talking to them like a friend, somebody, a confidant you can try to relax with. And sometimes I get those, I'm not saying nothing to you. I get cursed out, get away from here. Some of them are selectively mute, so you don't know anything about them. And hopefully over time, if they're getting medicated, start to come to therapy, hopefully we'll start to later on find out a little bit more information about them. But it can be difficult trying to get information from people because they're in an environment they don't want to be in and they don't trust people.
Yeah. And probably most of the time they're forced into it.
Because there's nothing wrong to them. There's nothing wrong with them unless they come voluntarily. And then they have the misconception that I'm only here for a few days because I came here voluntarily. But it doesn't work like that. If they see certain things and they feel like you're not safe, doctors aren't going to let you go in a few days. You know, you have to be able to prove and be able to say, I have insight in this What are you going to change so you're not going to return? And are you safe in the community? Because the doctor's responsible once you're discharged. If anything happens to them or someone else.
Yeah. So the point that you just brought up about that time, sometimes it takes longer periods of time. They don't just open up to you right away. How often do you actually get to work with the clients? Is it kind of like a couple days a week? Do you get to see them for months? What does the frequency and duration of your services look like on your unit?
So we do groups. We do therapeutic groups. So occupational therapy groups are ran 7 days a week, and that includes holidays. So there's 4 OTRs, including myself, and we run 2 units apiece. And then we have CODAs to assist us with those units. So we do the groups. We talk about self-awareness, life skills, cognitive thinking, social skills, behavioral control. We try to do things like motivation, coping skills, leisure skills, self-care activities, everything that pretty much has to deal with occupation, and even including sleep. All those things are important. So we are educating and providing groups to assist with those in 45 minutes in length. On the weekends, it's typically 1 OTR, and you may have between 2 to 3 CODAs assisting. The CODAs pretty much run the groups on the weekend. If we're really shorthand, the OTR will assist with the groups, but we primarily are evaluating all the evals that come through the units, and that can be average 6 to 10 evals on a weekend.
Wow. That's a lot.
That you're trying to get. It's a lot. It is a lot. I mean, you're seeing all the traumas, you're seeing all these different diagnoses and the reason for admissions, and it can be very mentally draining. I work with a really good supportive staff of OTRs and assistants. We have to be there for one another. We vent, we laugh, we cry. We're like, how am I going to get through this? I can't handle this patient. Do you mind seeing this patient? Do you mind doing this group? So we kind of like feed off of one another. You really have to have a really good supportive staff to get through, because not only are you dealing with your own problems and issues at home, in the work environment, but also the patients that you're treating. So it can be tough, very challenging.
I can only imagine, again, not having worked in it before, I'm just like, yeah, I wouldn't even know where to start. How do you feel like the groups work within the dynamics of the populations and the patients that you're working with? Do they like the groups? Do they kind of start where they're like, I don't know about this, and then they warm up to it? Like, what does that look like?
Everybody's style is different, and that really makes a difference on how receptive clients are with wanting to attend the groups. I truly believe you have people who like to do a lecture format. Yeah, those just pretty much laid back and kind of like let the patients kind of, we just kind of facilitate, you know what I mean? And try to get them engaged, to try to communicate, because a lot of them don't want to talk. A lot of people don't like to talk in front of other people or be in large groups. There's certain things that we have to take into consideration, triggers, you know what I mean? So it all depends on the style. Me, I'm like, hey, I'm your homegirl. I'm your homegirl from down the block. I'm your friend. I'm your cousin. I'm your sister. So my style is a little different. I'm more laid back, and I really use therapeutic use of self. I am really, really good with therapeutic use of self. I hate to toot my own horn, but some days I have to do it. And if it's, hey, good morning. How are everybody doing today? It's Monday. I'm feeling good. Y'all ready for group? I got to get them pumped up. Come down to group. And it's days that I have patients just being very disruptive and want to control the group. I shut them down. I'm like, look, I didn't appreciate your behavior that you did. I was not here. I said, it's group today. You want to come? And he was like, yeah, I want to come. I said, I'm going to tell you, I'm about to set boundaries with you right now. If you can't sit and listen and try to be respectful of your peers or the staff, you can stay right here. If you find that you can't do that, I'm looking at you. You're a Delta Delta. I want that respect. And he's like, yeah, I could do it. I said, all right, because we don't have time to babysit and try to teach everybody else. This is a therapeutic environment. I want to give everybody the opportunity to learn, to find something that's going to be beneficial for them. They respect me for that.
Yep.
You know what I mean? So I am who I am. I know I don't pretend, I don't sugarcoat or none of that. I might swear a couple times in my group. They respect me for that. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm using common language that they use every day. Well, pretty much I feel like the turnout is good some days because I speak to people at their level. I like to, if it's a group, I like to sit down when I can and talk to people eye to eye. I don't like to talk down to people as if I'm superior or better than them. I'd never put on that persona. I want them to know that I'm your equal because I could be sitting in that same seat as they're sitting in. And it's the truth. Life has a way of, you never know what's going to happen when you walk out the door.
Mm-hmm.
Anything can happen. Your whole mood can change. Your whole life can change. And it can land you in places where no one wants to be. So I totally get it. And I'm like, I'm human just like you. And I could be sitting where you are. But I would want somebody like myself to tell me it's okay. It's okay to ask for help. It's okay to say, you know what? I really screwed up. And I need to find out better ways to make me a better me. I would want somebody there for me. I mean, if I had to do it all over again, I don't regret becoming a physical therapist assistant and working with people and all other different type of things that I did because it made me the person who I am today. I enjoy being OT, and I didn't know anything about occupational therapy when I was going to school for PT assistant. And, you know, when you're working alongside different disciplines, you're able to see more. You're getting that hands-on observational type of thing. So it's like, you know what? This is pretty cool because if you can't get to somebody here, you can't get to them nowhere. It starts here.
Exactly.
It starts here.
It starts with that connection piece.
It does.
So I have to ask, do you have a favorite group, a favorite topic, a favorite diagnosis? Like, do you have anything that you're like, this is my jam? And it's like, yeah, it just like lights you up when you get to work with somebody within that.
I like to talk about stigma and mental health. I like to talk about healthy relationships. I like to talk about anyday topics, things that bother people, their fears. I mean, you know, I just like to sit down and kick it with people. It fits the world to me. I like to talk about resilience. I like to talk about the can I ask for help things, you know, because a lot of times, even myself, it was a pride. You were considered weak if you needed help or asked for help. So a lot of the things that I do have passion about, I have experienced myself. So it's easier to talk about. And I'm pretty open. I do a lot of self-disclosure. I am who I am. You know, I'm not sugarcoating it. No white shirts with button downs here. It's loosen up the tie and unbutton the first two buttons on the shirt. This is what you get. You know what I'm saying? So anything, because, you know, most of the people that I see are people that live in my community. I run into these same people that I work with at the grocery store, running to go put gas in the car. So I've had been in the store and I've had patients run up to me and you really helped me out. And they'll come and give me a hug. Some of them just need a hug. You know what I mean? Somebody cared about me and I'm able to give them that and I'm okay with it. So anything I feel passionate about and if I'm speaking about it, it's because I've been through it myself and, you know, I can relate.
I'm just kind of reflecting on in the beginning where you didn't really think you wanted to go into mental health. And now as you're talking right. about what you're passionate about, I'm like, that is all mental health. Like that is it yes. right there. Like, I think you found your niche, even though you yes. weren't thinking you'd end up there. And I appreciate the honesty and kind of the rawness of sharing about your own experiences and also how that kind of translates into the job that you do. And how do you feel like when you open up about stigma that you've gone through, maybe some of your own mental health stuff, how do you feel like your clients are receptive to that?
And you bring on a different energy. You bring an energy that is hard to explain. I enjoy coming to your groups, Danielle. And that makes me feel good. And some people don't like constructive criticism, but in order for me to make the group beneficial for you, I need to know what you thought of the group today. I need feedback and I need to know if you enjoyed it. And is there anything I need to change? And if I get a smile and, hey, I was looking for you today. Where were you? You know, I ain't seen you in a couple of days. You know what I mean? But I'm thinking about it. It was just Halloween last weekend. I care about my patients. I'm like, they're here. It's COVID. They don't want to be here. I'm getting Halloween candy for all my groups. I'm like, candy, let's go here. Candy. They were appreciative of that. It's just the little things.
Yeah.
But that, you know, it's COVID and we're taking on students and it's a lot to take on students and all the restrictions we have. But I always try to tell students when you get into mental health, it's nothing to be afraid of. It's a different environment. Yes, we have locked doors. We have to have key passes to go through. There's keys. We have the door shut. And that could be intimidating. I said, but you have to look as if it's your mother, your brother, your father, you know, being kind. So, you know, with all COVID, a lot of things have been shut down. So we're, I don't want to say bombarded, but in so many senses we are. And we're dealing with a lot of changes. So we've been taking on a little bit more students than we usually would just to help because it's hard times right now and they need to get their internships and stuff like that done. The environment can be very intimidating for people who've never worked with people. That's why I feel like, you know, when we went on to try to get admitted into school, become OTRs or assistants, they want you to do observation hours. I feel like that's very important. People sometimes don't look into the profession as they look at more of the dollar figure sometimes and not really understand that we're dealing with people. And then depending on what field you're in, you're going to be touching people. People know when you feel uncomfortable with them. So I feel like maybe sometimes doing a job where you do have to work with people hands on, talking with people, getting to know people is important because you still need to be able to communicate. And a lot of people aren't and doing what I do. I work in groups. So to a lot of people, that's more like public speaking. You're talking in front of let's say 3 to sometimes 17 people at one time. You have to be comfortable with that. Not a lot of people are comfortable with that. So it's important at least try to get in a job where you can spend time and ask questions and talk to somebody one-on-one besides your mom or your father, somebody or your boyfriend, your girlfriend. I mean, make small talk conversations out in public, elevator talk. Can you bring up conversation and conversation flow a little bit? Because it really makes a difference. Because the patients, they asking you all types of questions. They want to know your business. Why are you here?
Oh, they're going to dig in.
They're the interviewer sometime. Yeah. They're going to dig in. And they know when you're nervous and it can make you cry. You have to have backbone. You have to be able to stand your ground. You know what I mean? So it can be very difficult for patients and for students in that you have to have a certain kind of personality. You have to be able to stand your ground. They can teach you everything in school, but some things you have to learn over time because it's a tough field. Mental health is a tough field, but it's fun. I love it. I love it. Yeah. I'm not lifting. I'm not pulling the knobs and 10 screws in my back from all the lifting and pulling and tugging on people. You know what I mean? Now I can use my voice. I'm able to use my voice and not so much my body. And that makes a big difference. You know, and I feel like I may have paid my dues to get where I'm at, but I'm happy.
That's all that matters, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So I know that you've said a lot of kind of these challenges and struggles and difficulties about the job, but like, what would you say for you? What is the hardest part about working in the area that you do?
Sometimes you do get overwhelmed. Sometimes it's my reaction to things because of the population in a group. A sudden change that takes place. Oh, we got to go in a certain room or the television isn't acting right the way you want it to act. Those little things. And sometimes that can kind of set me off. But then I apologize. Like, look, you see what I'm saying, people? I said, I've tried to teach you guys, you know what I'm saying? When things are out of your control, you can't take it to heart. But guess what? I'm human just like you guys. This is out of my control right now. And I'm just going to take me a deep breath and we're going to get through this group, you know, and dealing with people, including yourself.
I feel like that is such a good learning opportunity for your patients and your clients because they're seeing you go through some difficulties, mm-hmm. some things that you weren't planning on happening or anything like that. And it's like, look, this is life. Like, this is literally life right here, right now. Yeah. I can get mad and I can yell and I can throw and I can hit people, or I can. And then you can teach whatever kind of skill yes. that it is that you're working on. So
and that's what I try to do. That's what I try to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the hardest part. And this might be hard, narrow it down, but what's the best part about your job?
planning a group and it goes successfully and they learn from it, and you have a group that nobody wants to talk and you can get everybody engaged. They are just so happy. You know, I had one patient who was off on a tangent. I had to get him to step out, but I was able to keep my group under control and everybody was engaged and giving their thoughts and points of view, and everybody in that, and it was a communication group. And I was explaining, like, communication is big. And no matter when you're trying and being assertive, you know, we use different type of tactics. If it's being aggressive communication, understanding what it is being aggressive communication, sub versus submissive or passive versus assertive, what we very sometimes ever use, but it's the best form of communication. And you can get so much accomplished just by your delivery and your tone and getting your point across. And to get my group to engage and give their points of view and the things that they're going through, that meant a lot to me.
Oh, I love that. I think that's great, because I'm sure a lot of the times they don't go as you plan or as you hoped.
They'll be sitting there and don't say nothing. Worst group.
Yeah. You're just like, oh gosh, what am I going to do? How am I going to?
When is this over?
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah. I know kind of in the beginning of the episode, and actually maybe a couple other times, you did touch on how you kind of navigate and how you deal with your own mental health and your own emotional health going through and kind of working at this job. But what advice would you have for other therapy practitioners or maybe students that are on field work in this setting? What advice do you have about maintaining your own mental health while also working in an emotionally challenging environment?
You definitely need social supports, someone you can talk to. I have a counselor that I speak with once a month. And if I need more visits, I speak to him more than once a month. Some of my coworkers see people once a week. The same like the patients they're going through, we need, you know. I have to take my medication the way I'm supposed to. If I miss taking my medication, taking your medications, and here I am not taking mine, and it affects you. It affects you in so many ways. So I make sure I'm doing that. I need a release. If it's taking a walk, getting some exercise, meditation. I was having difficulty with sleeping at night. So I downloaded a Calm app and I listened to sleep stories. The same thing I'm teaching my patients, I've experienced and I've tried myself. Sometimes when I was out on comp or my back, I didn't know what to do. Here, my change. And a lot of people we're dealing with, a lot of people that's dealing with COVID right now that's coming through the doors, and people's structure and occupations have changed tremendously and they don't know what to do with their time. So I got into coloring. I like to color now. Different tools for their toolbox, what we call a coping toolbox. And that's what we need. I need to talk and vent to someone. I need to ask for help. You know, it's good to ask for help. A lot of people have problems with asking for help. A lot of people don't say, you know, I'm really dealing with this and I have problems and I need to help. The biggest problem is asking for help in self-care. We're always helping others and nobody. And we don't take time to take care of ourselves. And that's huge. That goes with eating correctly, trying to find the right diet. I mean, I had to change what I ate. You know, certain foods started to bother me. So what I eat, the amount of sleep I'm getting, the amount of activity I'm doing, all that takes into effect. Work, 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 work. You have to have balance.
Yeah. I'm really glad that you brought up the part about it's okay to ask for help and it's okay being a therapist and going to see somebody, going to see a therapist, talking to somebody. How did that start with you? Did somebody recommend, like, hey, this is going to be challenging, you're probably going to want to find somebody to talk to? Or was that something internally that you were like, I'm not going to make it if I don't seek out help on my own? Because I know a lot of people challenge with kind of overcoming that of like, I'm the therapist, I should know how to handle my own mental health and I should know how to handle my own self-care. So how did you get to that point where you are like, I need to seek out help for my own good?
School, when I was in school, yeah. Dealing with life changes, here I am, a working adult, life changes, coming back to be a traditional student, a student that's been out of school for a number of years. I was doing online school, so I have a couple of different degrees online, but I was back in the classroom, not on the computer, doing schoolwork assignments. And school was rigorous. champagne taste, but beer money, barely on a beer, maybe an empty can for a nickel deposit. So things was hard. And I mean, I was just in like, am I going to make it? I made all these changes in my life and I don't think I'm going to succeed. I don't think I'm going to get through this. What can I do? And you know, you deal with things in your life, your different hurdles. And sometimes you harbor those things, no matter how busy you try to keep yourself. We try to put things on the back burner. But if you don't let things go that has bothered you, it will come back to the forefront again and affect your relationship and the things that you're trying to accomplish. So I needed to go to seek counseling. I want to seek to focus more on what's more important to me. Again, refocus on the goals that I had, because I started to lose all of that because I couldn't focus. It was too much coming at me at one time and I didn't know how to handle it. After school, another thing starts to come up, trying to find a job and my health, things started changing. I had to seek counseling again. You know, my parents are getting older. They were getting sick. You know, then just so recently, my father died. I need counseling again. So I talked to my doctor. If something is not right, I'm going to the doctor. I need all the help I can get. And I say, close mouth, don't get fed. You're the most important person. We're helping people. You can't help others if you don't have the core foundation, and that's you. So I had to focus on me. If it's bad habits that I thought was good habits at one particular time, it's not any longer. You know what I mean? Those are bad habits that are starting to affect me and my future. If it's affecting my health, it's affecting how I produce myself on a day-to-day basis. So it's all about self-care. And again, asking for help. We are not any different from anybody that we treat.
Yeah. Gosh, I feel like you've shared so much that I'm just like, yeah, like it all resonates and it all just makes sense. And it's so humanistic, right? What you deal with, what you go through, mm-hmm. you can help your clients relate to that and you can relate to your clients through that. And that's super. Yeah. It's like, it's so cool. And I have a million things that I'm thinking in my head right now, but I have this one question that I'm really curious about. What is one thing that a client has taught you that has just stuck with you forever, that you'll just remember forever and ever and ever?
My mom always calls me the therapy whisperer.
Love it.
And it didn't so happen with occupational therapy. It happened when I was a physical therapist assistant, because I was able to get a patient who was so deconditioned, so ill that he couldn't do anything for himself. And I worked with an assistant, Akota. We were both assistants, and she was new out of school, but I had been in so many different areas. I had so much background, so many things that I have learned over the years. I feel like sometimes I was a little bit above. I should have been a PT. That's how I felt, you know, very good at hands-on skills. And so I would tell her to do certain things while I did certain things on my end of the spectrum. I was able to get the man to roll over on his side, roll over in bed, sit up on the side of the bed, feed himself, get himself dressed, go to the bathroom, walk out the door. Where he was a total hoyer lift. He couldn't do anything for himself. That's something that will always resonate with me. But I've had many stories, to tell you the truth, Sarah, that I've affected many people. And I feel any therapist, this is what we were trained to do. You know what I mean? And the most reward is to make someone feel good about themselves. And I've made many people feel good about themselves. I've learned over the years, I had patients that I felt like was going to be the worst patient ever, and we became best friends by the end. You know, I've had patients, they'd be like, who is this girl coming up in here? I'm at funerals. I'm giving roses. They become a part of your family. If you're with them long enough, become a part of your family. And that's hard. You know, they teach us about grievance. You grieve over patients that you work with for so long and they pass away. It's made me who I am, you know. I had to kick myself in my own butt, because after having back surgery, I'm like, oh my God, I'm the patient again. And for someone to tell me that I can't do the job that I worked hard to do, I'd be damned. Anybody tell me I can't have what I want, and I'm doing it. And I work for it, and I continue to work for it, I'm in a better place than I am right now than I was 2 months ago. Well, my endurance is better, supports, but I had to tell myself, look, you cannot let anybody tell you you can't do it.
Yep.
You have to get it for yourself. Has to come from here. This is where it starts. Your heart and passion. Watch me. I can show you better than I could tell you. That's right.
Words to live by. I'm just like, yeah, exactly. Okay. So this has been amazing. Absolutely amazing. So if people want to get in contact with you, they want to reach out to you, how can they find you?
So it's the life of OT. So Queen the Life, DALIFE of OT. And you can add me on there on Instagram. If you feel comfortable asking me any questions, try to respond as much as possible. Sometimes I'm just busy and I'm trying to get my life together. So it's always 2 months. These past 2 months have been really busy for me, but these are all going to fall into place.
I know that feeling. All right. One last question for you. One word. If you are only given one word to describe occupational therapy, what would it be?
Oh, now see, I'm going to give you a quote.
I know, right? It's like, I feel like this is why I asked the question, because I feel like we can say so much about OT, but like boiling it down to like one little thing, everyone's like, I don't know if I can do that. Can I write a novel? I'm like, no.
I can't write no novel on this one. Oh my God. No. My one word would be definitely resilience. Resilience.
Love it.
Definitely OT is considered resilience. I mean, it's a field that has been, they're trying to act like we're obsolete, but what we need to do is show our passion and take advantage of what we already have. We can't let nobody come in and take what we have. So the resilience is that we continue to push forward and still represent occupational therapy as a whole. We never die. It's a never dying profession.
I'm just like, can we just do like a mic drop? Like, bam, that's the best way to finish that episode. Just mic drop with that one. The whole time I'm like, hands up. I'm like, hell yeah.
OT been around for 103 years in the profession. So we've come a long way. We're going to have to keep sticking it out, because we got to show all the other professions that we still exist.
We got work to do, and we got to just continue to show people that we are here and we can do a lot of really good work. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Danielle. This was truly enlightening and really informative for me, learning about your practice area and kind of everything that you deal with on a daily basis. So thank you from the bottom of my heart for coming on the show, sharing your journey, sharing your passion of mental health, and really just keeping it real with me. So thank you. This was amazing.
Well, I really enjoyed myself, and anything I can do to help out as much as I can, I'm more than willing. So I thank you for the opportunity as well, Sarah.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. If you like what you hear, here are three easy ways you can help support the show. 1, head over to otforlife.com to find out more about any resources discussed on the show. Remember, that's OT4LYFE.com. 2, share the podcast with a friend, colleague, or anyone interested in occupational therapy. 3, subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast player so you don't miss out on any upcoming episodes. And while you're there, be sure to leave a review saying how much you love the show. Thanks again. I'll catch you next time, OT for Lifers. Thank you. That was fantastic, minus all the freaking tech issues, but let's see if it comes back. There we go. All right. It was cutting in and out there. Hopefully we're back.
You look like you're frozen.
I know. Man, we were good. And then all of a sudden it was like, yes. The whole time. That's fine. But I was going to ask, what was my question? Hold on. I had it. What was my question? I totally had a question.
It's okay. Still there, Sarah?
I'm here.
Did anything cut off?
Yes. Just that very last part, literally, I think it was like your last couple sentences and that was it. I think I just realized why my internet's being funky. And I think it's because my husband is watching TV through the internet. I'm like sitting there and I'm like, what is different about today?
Is it a Netflix night?
No, I think he's just paying attention to the election.
Oh, yeah.
But he has to, like, stream it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get it.
I'm just going to tell him to stop for 1 second.
Good luck with that.
Gosh, I know. He's probably asleep, too, on the couch. So.
Or I might swear.
Okay. I didn't get any of that. Okay. Literally, it, like, froze. And all I saw was you just, like, did to do. And I'm like, I don't even know if she heard me say the question.
Okay.
Hold on.
It's okay.
Now I just lost my other question. Okay. What was I going to say? Oh, so, okay. I feel like I'd be the exact same way. When somebody says no, I'm like, watch me. Hold my beer. I'll be back.
Yes, yes, yes.